Way. This is Patrick Miner's podcast, and welcome, Kathy.
Thank you so much for inviting me today. Yes, my name is Kathleen Marr. I'm the executive director of the Barnum Museum, just about an hour outside of New York in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
And the three museums that burn, and two, and then the tornado damage. You probably aren't going to like this language, but you seem like kind of giant. I mean, you just seem like you've got the personality to wrap your arms around this big project.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to say, because you don't necessarily know that when a situation is upon you. I'm a daughter of a Marine. That the fight or flight thing, it's clear, which I adopted, you know, from my dad. But you just don't know. And I think you're right. I think it does take a certain kind of personality trait, or what are you going to do? Could have thrown in the towel, said, this is not my path, or just having the faith that this place was worthy of the great load that it took. Not just me, you know, we've had staff kind of circle through, but the couple of us that are here right now have been here since the early beginning. Adrienne, our curator, came on board. She was one of my first responders. I did help. She worked at another museum. And I said, take the job of saving the artifacts while I save the building. And she said, yes. So imagine that. And then our assistant director, who is really the glue that keeps all of the business pieces together, he's been at this for a long time, too. So collectively, we're an ecosystem that's gotten through every challenge that this situation has brought.
It's interesting you use that metaphor, because it seems to me that P.T. Barnum himself somehow or other created an ecosystem, such a large new reality before he assembled it.
It really did not. Certainly there were big entertainment venues and performances in Europe, not so much in America during the early to mid-19th century. There's a scholar, Michael Chemers, actually said this to me once. He said he had to have been a time traveler, because how could he have known? How could he be so spot on so many times what the temperature of a newly emerging American culture was going to be, what people wanted? I mean, there was a huge void. A lot of people don't realize in the 1830s and 1840s in New York City, the struggles that people had were really, it was really the Irish immigration coming in. It was a tough place down at the Bowery. So entertainments, the way we think of them today, family entertainment, simply did not exist. There were no theaters and recreation halls where it was appropriate for women and children to go. Audience were predominantly male. There was drinking, there was violence, there was risque behavior. None of that was palatable for family entertainment then or now, right? Barnum recognized there's an audience that's just simply not getting tapped into. Clean it up. Let's do this. Let's clean it up. So when he opened his American Museum, it was 25 cents to get in. You could stay all day. If you wanted to have a drink or smoke, you had to exit the building, completely exit the building, and pay full price to get back in. So there was a zero tolerance order at the museum. And even at his theaters, yeah, so he created the Morrill Lecture Hall, because it was in the museum and not an amphitheater in town someplace. It was deemed as more wholesome, and he promoted it as wholesome moral entertainment, instructive entertainment. But they would perform temperance plays all the time for families to come and see. They had the temperance pledge out the doors of the theater, so women would drag their husbands to sign the temperance pledge. So he walked the walk, and he too was one of the country's leading temperance champions. Time. He went on tour, and just about an hour outside of New York in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It is an extraordinary story. Everybody just lands on the circus. The truth is that the circus that we think of today, he was more than 61 when he embarked on this enterprise. He had decades of creating a modern entertainment industry, more of what we think of today. And just as a side note, P.T. Barnum was inducted into the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions Hall of Fame as the founder of the global attractions industry. What that means is he's sitting alongside, with his influence and his relevance in entertainment and attractions industry, with Walt Disney. So without Barnum's original, early, extraordinary vision to create massive entertainment that would make people happy and curious and think of the world as a wondrous place, where would we be today? Disney wouldn't have had that model.
How did he become the person that is such a wondrous, amazing person?
That is a great question. You automatically think that these people just appear miraculously. He's born in 1810 in Bethel, Connecticut, and his family was very modest. Where a lot of people think of the movie, and I'll just get that out there. Take the movie out of your head. The movie shows him and his dad in New York City and going running for the train back to Bethel, Connecticut. And the truth is that the train was not invented yet. This moment in the movie would have been like 1820. And so none of that happened, and he was not destitute. He was one of 11 kids. His mother, it came from a well-to-do family. Her parents owned most of the town of Bethel. They owned the shop. And his dad dies when he's 15. 15-year-old boy in 1820s, time to get to work and help support the family. So he did that. Now, we're very lucky because his autobiography, he begins writing in 1855, and he tells Barnum himself tells the stories about his grandfather.
What I heard you say is that his grandfather was a storyteller, and that P.T. picks up on that.
I am so glad you said that. Yes, you're absolutely right. His grandfather was a storyteller, and Barnum was a master storyteller. Right. And it could take me longer to write a one-pager about P.T. Barnum because there's so much. How do you tell these influential stories, not just to his life, but stories that really impact us today, whether it's through an entertainment lens or through a political lens? People don't realize Barnum was very prolific in his ideas about how the nation was going to move forward. And he was elected to the Connecticut General Assembly just at the end of the Civil War. This is 1865. And his platform was really to take down Vanderbilt and the railroad schemes, but also to write the amendment to the Connecticut Constitution to expand citizenship. Ultimately, he was a huge proponent of ensuring that all men are created equal. And to elaborate on that, he was also part of women's suffrage. He was giving women at his American Museum, 1856, the right to vote in a presidential primary. And in the 1850s, he's offering women, your voice counts. Barnum had a sympathetic ear to all of that. And Barnum's American Museum opens on New Year's Day, 1842. That becomes a destination, right? So people have to go to it. I mean, New York City was not even at 14th Street at this point, right? There are no bridges. New York is not colonial like Boston or Philadelphia. It's much more industrial. It has an industrial history. It was a lot of commerce and a lot of activity downtown. And taking little micro exhibitions and spotting them around in different places would be a way to get him further into some of the larger cities and communities, get him exposure, and all roads lead back to Barnum's American Museum. You see that when he introduces Tom Thumb, Charles Stratton, the little boy, literally has a pituitary disorder. It's a form of dwarfism, so he never grew to full size. At the time Barnum met Charles, he was about 24 inches tall. Barnum bills him as the marvel of nature. He assigns him different characters, and he travels with him even to England and France and Germany and Belgium. They meet the crown heads of state, and it didn't happen miraculously. It was a lot of work, and Barnum's good friend Horace Greeley helped create these engagements. But he was able to bring Tom's performance back to New York, do a whole American circuit as well. There has never been a global celebrity like that before. This is the 1840s. By the time Barnum negotiates a contract with the coloratura soprano Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, she was already extremely established in Europe. Everybody knew Jenny Lind. Now, Barnum, when he was traveling with Tom, heard of her, never heard her sing, But just through the newspaper, he was absolutely dazzled by the form of entertainment. Barnum did visit opera houses, that he actually even said he preferred that grade of entertainment more than some of the performances he had at his American Museum. And he negotiated a deal and brought Jenny Lind to America. So the contract was signed in 1849. She arrives in 1850 to New York. And he knew that Americans had no idea what opera was. He knew, I can't sell her on her extraordinary talent. I have to sell her on the way she was promoted in Europe. She was enormously generous. She was pious. She was humble. All of these characteristics, these moral, wholesome characteristics, Barnum knew is what would appeal to an altruistic American society. And just tens of thousands of people actually came to hear her sing. And it changed the face of entertainment in this country. People who never really cared about anything musical just wanted to see, get a glimpse of Jenny Lind. And they did. So it becomes really America's, the Jenny Lind Hall that Barnum builds for her performance really becomes the first Metropolitan Opera House.
General Tom Thumb just finished, and now the crowd eagerly awaits the Swedish Nightingale, Jenny Lind. What a large person she immediately became in the country. And I'm immediately thinking of all the private journals everywhere, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Kentucky, all of them scratching a note in there about having seen or want to go see or my cousin saw Jenny Lind.
Yes. At that moment in time, everybody knew that it was something big. You know, let everybody know that I saw Jenny Lind and you did, you know, just like we do the same kind of stuff today. You know, we haven't really changed much, but yeah, the sensation and the buildup. And Barnum, and that's where he was brilliant. He understood that the hype is what that would make people really get stimulated about a particular event and then have to deliver on it. Barnum writes that he was very concerned about Jenny Lind with the amount of hype, and they had contests, and there were 30,000 people waiting for her to get off the ship. And backstage before she started singing, he writes, "My God, I hope I have not missed the mark on this." And he said, as soon as she started singing, all of his concerns just faded, and that they'd never seen anyone with this level of talent on the American shores before. And here's an interesting point. Opera singers did come to this country, and they performed for the elite and the educated, the wealthy, the traveled. It was not for everybody. This is the critical part about Barnum's story. Barnum made entertainment accessible to everyone, not just the upper class society. That's the key difference. So anyone could go here, Jenny. Anyone could go to the museum. Now, Barnum brought those collections to the American Museum, so everybody had the opportunity to see them. Kind of museum, but it gave people the exposure and the accessibility and the opportunity to see the world beyond the limits of where they were. And it was a day-long commitment. You had to travel there by horse and carriage, if you had that, or walk. People really were invested in giving Barnum, trusting Barnum with their time and their money to be entertained. And I'll be gosh darn if we don't use those same words when you want to make a family trip to Disney World, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about the Disney World experience. And Disney World, you know, it has a way to get us viscerally hooked well before we get to Orlando.
And that's exactly what Barnum did over 100 years ago. And it didn't necessarily matter if you saw something real or if it wasn't real. It was the opportunity. What's interesting about Barnum and his story, too, is Barnum even writes this, the story of the Fiji mermaid. For all of Barnum's stories, that's the story that he comes back to and writes. He goes, "That was not some of my best work. I duped the public a little too much. There was always an authentic experience that a guest was going to have. And that was his end of the day accomplishment, that he was going to deliver something good. He didn't mind the critics. People are intrigued. It heightens the curiosity. Again, not so different from how we are today. Just a little bit of context. In the 1840s, Barnum borrows from a Boston friend and colleague, museum proprietor Moses Kimball, a body of a monkey, tail of a fish, sewn together masterfully, and looks like creature from the seas. And Barnum creates a whole story that it was in the possession of a naturalist from England, and he was traveling around the United States and ultimately get him up to the American Museum. Barnum puts huge bills on the American Museum exterior of beautiful mermaids. And the truth is, this creature thing was just hideous, you know? And
is it still exist somewhere?
The interesting thing, and the jury's out a little bit, when the exhibit was done, the Fiji mermaid went back to Moses Kimball, and the Moses Kimball collection was ultimately donated to the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. Right now, Harvard University has two of these, and it's possible that one of the two could be one that Barnum borrowed.
Certainly sounds hideous.
It was hideous.
Okay, there's a couple things that really impressed me as I was preparing for conversation. And one is the fact that two of Barnum's museum burned to the ground.
Yeah. The original American Museum was on Broadway and Ann Street, and it was big, many, many floors. It had a rooftop garden, 38 million people from 1842 to 1865 visited the museum. Now, going back to Barnum's politics and being a strong supporter of the Northern cause and an emancipationist, a year before the American Museum burns down, there is a hit list for New York City sites for arson, some type of Southern sympathizer terrorism. At one point, a fire was discovered at the American Museum, and it was put out right away. But sadly, a second fire, whole entire museum went up in flames. Just tragic, heart-wrenching. But no human life was lost, but of course there are animals. The American Museum is really one of the country's first aquarium, and it's an inside zoo as well. Great loss there. And it was a devastation to the country to hear this. Nothing was saved from that fire. So this is 1865. He didn't have enough insurance to cover it. And what was happening is the theaters were doing fundraisers for the people that worked for Barnum's American Museum, because there's no unemployment benefits, and he employed hundreds of people. So this was a huge blow to the economy as well for the performers. So they were raising money through fundraisers to help support the families. Barnum pulled himself together and up the street at another building, much, much smaller, that Barnum took ownership of and created a second American Museum. And that opened quickly after the first fire. And then in 1868, that burned. The cause of that fire was a boiler failure. Barnum was also hugely interested in scientific advancements, technological advancements, and he was trying to incorporate new systems into New York's urban infrastructure development, and the boiler failed. And that actually happened at the Hippotheron as well. That was on 14th Street, so he lost the Hippotheron as well.
Now, that's an unusual name. I don't quite understand it. Hippotheron?
It was an establishment that was going to showcase, much like the American Museum, larger indoor performances. The Theron, it really never opened. From inception to its demise was barely 3 months. And there were a lot of museum collections already to get installed at that point, and they lost all of that too. After the two museum fires, his friend Horace Greeley says, go a fishing. So now we're in the moment in American history where westward expansion, and when you're looking at the domes of the Yosemite and all of the great national parks, after the second museum burnt, he went west to experience the great American wilderness. And that's when Barnum said, rest but not rust. He goes, my energies are too peculiar to just coast through the rest of my life. Only in the 60s. And then ultimately they pulled together. And this is the 150th anniversary year. The Greatest Show on Earth opens in Brooklyn. He couldn't open the show in Manhattan because he leased his name to another museum proprietor, and there was a no-compete clause. So people knew during his lifetime the power of his name, which hasn't really faded. I mean, look, we're sitting here, we're still talking about him.
It's absolutely amazing. And the more I was reading in preparation for the conversation, the more bewildered I was. Just the word humbug, that was a big part. I started to read his book about that topic.
And humbug means something different to us today. But in Barnum's definition, and I don't have it precisely in front of me, so forgive, I'll paraphrase a little. But Barnum writes, in my definition, humbug is management, to take an old truth and put it into an attractive form. That's how Barnum saw the word humbug.
It seems like it's got a sinister meaning.
No, it wasn't sinister. It was all in good fun. He's born in Bethel, and it was Barnum's brother who knew about the Charles Stratton family and introduced Barnum to Tom Thumb. So that's really what got Barnum here. He was enchanted by the city, and it has a very vibrant harbor. It has a deep harbor where commerce could in and out. And by the 1830s, 1838, the train lines are running straight through Bridgeport. And for those that don't know, we literally run on the coast to New York, an hour, 15-minute train ride from Bridgeport to New York City. Barnum saw Bridgeport as a perfect, beautiful, it's on the Long Island Sound, untouched, raw nature. And he said, this is a perfect place for me to settle my family. And in 1840s, he decided to build his first estate and called, it was an Oriental villa called Iranistan. It was modeled after the Brighton Pavilion in England. So it had beautiful, massive domes, turrets that would reach to the sky. It was extraordinary by its color and the grounds and the exotic nature of it. In 1848, he builds Iranistan. The family moves in. It's beautifully appointed. It becomes a showpiece unto itself. People would want to come and see it, see the grand appointments. It's great P.T. Barnum, and it certainly suited his character. And sadly, it was a moment in time where American Museum was well established. His political voice was really becoming recognizable in the platform of the country at the time. He has this wonderful estate. He's arrived, and workmen left some type of smoking device burning, and the entire place, it was finished in 1847, so by 1857, the Iranistan mansion burned down. Again, no one hurt, but what a sad thing. A few objects actually did survive fire. They managed to get some furniture out, and we have that in our collection. Barnum himself donated those pieces to this museum, but he didn't give up on Bridgeport. His wife, Harity, was a little bit sickly. They suggested she move closer to the Long Island Sound for the restorative peace and calmness, beautiful breezes. So they did, closer to the Long Island Sound, and they lived there. And it's during this time also that Barnum saw the opportunities of the city of Bridgeport as having the potential of being the next great urban place, second to New York City. So with trains established, the turnpike companies, the harbor was already active, he decided to embark on creating an industrialized city and entice different types of manufactories to come in and set up. The first one to really come in is the Wheeler Wilson Sewing Machine Manufacturing Companies. It's what they did. Sewing machines were a big deal in the 1850s. Now, before this all took off, because here we are today in Bridgeport in 2021 as a result of Barnum's vision. But what happened, and probably one of the most important Barnum stories, is as he was developing Bridgeport, he enticed the Jerome Clock Company to come into Bridgeport and really establish themselves. He purchased the company. He wound up purchasing the debt. There was no exposure on the amount of debt that the company transferred to burden Barnum personally. It completely bankrupted Barnum. Ultimately, Barnum had to mortgage the American Museum. It destroyed him in a lot of ways. He just lost everything. He lost his reputation. He felt he lost his reputation. As it turns out, he had created such a culture of people, oh my gosh, you know, how could this have happened to the great Barnum? How can we help? And people offered to help him, give him money. He refused to take anything. He just said, this is my fault. This was my miscalculation. after mortgaging everything, their houses, scaling the whole family down, it was Charles Stratton, Tom Thumb, who went off on his own to become a millionaire unto his own right. He didn't necessarily need Barnum. They were friends their entire lives. But it was Tom who said to Barnum, it's like, hey, old friend, let's take the show back on the road. And to England, they do a whole tour over there. It gets Barnum back on his feet. And at that point, Oxford University students wanted Barnum. It's like, this is the great Barnum. We've got to hear him. And he was like, are you out of your minds? I'm here because I'm broke. And ultimately, it was Barnum's book, and it's downloadable for free, The Art of Money Getting. Barnum wrote The Art of Money Getting, and it became his lecture. And it was the principles for running a business. All the people that wanted to hear him talk, it's like a self-made millionaire is always going to be a millionaire. You're going to find a way back. You are on the road. You are on your comeback. We want to see that. A curiosity, right? So The Art of Money Getting, I advise everybody on this call to read it and pass it forward. It's the precursor to the Disney way, and the principles are simple. Persevere. Read the newspapers. Read something useful every day. These simple, simple, 10 simple rules that can get you through the next thing. And it's still being used in universities. With that, Barnum does get back on his feet. He reclaims the American Museum. And he does. He really is one of America's very first self-made multimillionaires. And he chose to live in Bridgeport. Ultimately, they got the industrial plans set. Barnum owned so much land on the east side, he was eager to cultivate a skilled, energized workforce. Everybody had utilities. The utilities, whether it was gas lines or water lines, whatever it was, went to everyone's house. Everybody had those opportunities because it was immigrant populations. The first recognizable population to Bridgeport is the Irish. Everybody needed their churches. They needed their schools. They needed parks, ultimately a hospital. He created the water company. Not just the infrastructure of the business, he was creating the culture for the people and the families that were living here simultaneously. It was not in a vacuum. It was a holistic utopian idea of what a community needs to be healthy, for there to be a sense of well-being. So he rose Bridgeport with those ideals in place. I mean, it's inspirational when you think about it. And it did work. It functioned extremely well. Bridgeport is the largest city in the state of Connecticut. That's really how Bridgeport came to be. And he did become the mayor. And probably one of the very, very few Republican mayors. Barnum was one of the first Republicans with Lincoln and Horace Greeley. But after that, he was voted into the General Assembly.
You were describing the way he developed the underpinnings of values for and in Bridgeport. It reminded me that's the language that we used earlier for how he developed the entertainment business. So whatever it was, whatever these underlying principles were in his life, they were constantly used wherever, entertainment and the development of Bridgeport. Very interesting.
It is very interesting, and it's very easy, more usual than not, that people just put him in, he was a horrible person bag. And it's like, there are things, but the truth is, when you sort of lay out Barnum in a linear path and say, it's like, where did he land on certain things in his moment in time? He was extremely progressive. And he invested his time and his voice, his very public voice, in making those change. And same with animal rights. People also don't realize that he became friendly with Henry Berg, founder of the ASPCA. And not only did Barnum respect Henry Berg and the principles of the ASPCA, Barnum, in his will, donates thousands of dollars to the cause. So I don't know how Barnum's life was lived in 80 years.
The current museum is so fortunate because of all the bad luck, the boiler, the two buildings burning. There can't possibly be any threat to the current museum. There's not even light bulbs burning out, right?
Yeah, that expression of history repeats itself. Barnum does finally retire. He really lives out his last years here in Bridgeport. And he was divvying up a lot of his money, and he was making a major contribution to the Bridgeport YMCA, who the patricians there did not like his universalist beliefs. So Barnum's reaction to that was like, fine, I'll take it all of it back. And he did. And he builds the building that we're in today. So it's the Barnum Institute of Science and History. And it is so much smaller than his other museums. It's really not very big at all. But it's certainly a jewel in the heart of downtown Bridgeport with the massive domes. It's got that Richardsonian-esque exotics type of feel for it in its architectural elements. Sadly, he did not survive the completion of the building. He dies in 1891. The building is completed in 1893. It was a vibrant place of intellectual exchange and community engagement. Great Depression came. They were able to really reopen the museum with, and it has grown and developed and evolved into a more modern museum. And I got here in 98 as the curator. Became the director 2005, got everything organized, and then in 2010, an EF1 tornado hit downtown Bridgeport, and the museum was pretty much ground zero. And my entire life changed in less than 40 seconds. The building did not collapse, but boy, did it have a lot of damage. The year after the tornado, and we're still trying to save artifacts, get things cleaned. Following year 2011, we got hit with Hurricane Irene. Then the year after that, it was Superstorm Sandy. Forget the record snowstorms. And then COVID. It's been a journey of recovery. I wish I could do things as fast as Mr. Barnum did. And we're here today, and that's what we're doing. And things are coming together. It's been a tough 10 years. And relocated about 20,000 artifacts. We only lost one object to catastrophic damage. After 17 years of trying to make this building a National Historic Landmark, after 17 years, the Advisory Committee for National Historic Landmarks unanimously proved to make the Barnum Building a significant landmark, a National Historic Landmark. There's only about 2,500 in the country. It's been a journey. And like I said, I learn something new every day. And there's so much to talk about, so many different paths. And that's exciting for us. Oh my gosh. Did anybody know Barnum had the first dog shows in the country at the American Museum? Having wrestling matches.
Coming interview on the subject of trapeze. I suppose that Barnum had trapeze artists.
Yes. And even at the American Museum, Victoria, what was her name? Mademoiselle Victoria, the angel of the lofty wire or something. I think I totally screwed that up. But yes, there were, at the American Museum, there were at any given time up to 800,000 exhibits. That's another thing. People firmly plant Barnum in human curiosities. It was a small part of all the exhibitions, but performers were never considered freaks. That idea of the freak show really is late 19th century. So performers were billed as marvels of nature or natural wonders. And they could have been aerialists, small people. There was the great giants of like Anna Swan, the bearded lady, but also human curiosities were ballerinas. Again, something that was not really part of the culture of this country at all. So you would come to the American Museum and see ballet. That was a human curiosity. The bell ringers of Lancaster. Barnum loved how they would use bells and create this extraordinary, almost haunting music. So it just spanned the gamut. But the American Museum is also the first science center. So all types of technology was being exhibited. It was a perfumery. There was a wax figure department. There was the first, like I said, first aquarium in the country. Barnum knew about the one in London and opened the aquarium at the American Museum in 1856. It's the first zoo, but ancient relics, all types of accounts from the recent wars, artwork, sculptures. It goes on and on and on and on. Pigeonholing him down one path really limits our understanding of a big, what we all were. And it's social history. He couldn't have accomplished what he did without a well of humanity around him that were interested and were reading it and were acquiring all of this information and knowledge through these exhibitions and performances. So it's risk-taking. All things that we would do in our own lives, and put the lens on Barnum's story to say it's like he was able to accomplish this through his own adversity. And what were the tools that he had to get him to the next level? And what do you see that? How do you see that in your own life? So that's how we're going to tell the stories. Now, as far as it just being an object and a case, we don't expect to do that at all. What we intend to do is when you walk into the museum, that you're going to be transported. He titles his autobiography Struggles and Triumphs. He did not live in a society where people exposed the rawness of their emotions. Just didn't exist at that time. So we don't really know the depths of depression that he might have experienced at some of these moments for his businesses. And, you know, and then we didn't even touch on the personal tragedies. He lost a daughter before she was 2 years old. Other daughter died when she was in her 30s. You know, he lost Tom Thumb. He lost Jenny Lind. I mean, he lost his wife. He doesn't get into that because it wasn't that kind of world then. But he finds in that Jerome Clock Company debacle, when he loses everything, and he does relate that he sinks into that kind of despair. What he does say, and this is brief, this isn't like a whole chapter, he does say it's the moment that humanized him. Losing everything made him shine the light on the things that really mattered. And that's where I take my, you know, step in my life.
What you've done is important, and that is we all should stand up, brush the dust and dirt off of us, and get back on the horse. Everybody's got problems. Too often, people just stop. The problem was there, and they never went beyond that problem. P.T. Barnum might be the very best example of someone who can step over the problem, go on to the next problem, and continue. Kathy, I'm being selfish. I'm enjoying the conversation so much that I've taken way more time of yours than I should have. I thank you for the time and courtesies. With that, I'll say goodbye.
Okay. Thanks so much. You stay well. Everybody, stay well.